Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
With David Slack. It's not your first rodeo, is it, David?
I've been throwing off more horses than I can count.
Hey, a wonderful week for politics. Interesting sort of a tacky, slightly sticky, kind of curious week for politics, I thought. Just a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of bubblegummy this and a little bit of chewing gummy that. You know what I mean?
Yes, and some of it vegetarian.
And some of it vegetarian. Turns out that the Air New Zealand meat-free burger is causing all sorts of bluster.
It created a great opportunity for people to beat their patriotic chest, I thought. Nathan Guy in particular saying, "What's wrong with our airline that should be representing the work of our hard-working farmers?" As though there isn't a strong preference amongst people these days for eating something that hasn't actually been grown on a farm.
And as if and blindly missing the fact that farming may be destroying the country as well as earning it money.
Indeed. I've got myself in trouble with this before. One time I wrote a column and my father-in-law rang to say, "I was just wondering if you've got a pile of manure being tipped on your front lawn yet."
Yeah, I mean...
You upset people when you talk about this, but it's, you know, it's realistic. If we want the planet to function successfully with 10 billion people on it, we actually need to be doing a lot less...
commercial beef farming?
Yeah. We have a much better prospect of feeding the planet if the source of protein is something other than expensive animals who tax the planet's resources at about 10 times the volume of your lentils, your pulses, your insects. All viable options, Mikey.
Oh, look, I've eaten all of them. And you've got to ask yourself too, as far as journalists go, who's asking the acting prime minister whether he'd eat one? Surely you've got better questions than that for Winston Peters and his. Like, you can imagine how pissed off he would have been at that. He's come out and said, no, I eat the real thing. I'd never eat lab grown meat. And fair enough, that's his, you know, it's his choice, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's the one they're talking about is the Impossible Burger, which is Air New Zealand serving in business class. It's not like it's going to be decimating the beef industry in New Zealand too dramatically, you know.
It's a little like, you know, in Australia, you can stop any conversation dead in its tracks, any argument dead in its tracks by using the words "that's un-Australian," and it actually is the
we'll
last.
We'll just bring up the Aboriginals.
Oh well, yeah. There's that too. but it is the last refuge of the scoundrel to beat the patriotic drum. Actually, if you want your beef industry to thrive, then do your hardest. Do what you can to promote it, but don't expect everybody to simply promote it because they ought to, because it's New Zealand.
Yeah, because in the old days we all used to do it, sort of thing, yeah.
No, that's right. Yeah. And then, I don't know, it's a bit discouraging to see people not be looking forward, not being inventive, not recognising that maybe the way things have been working may not be the way things work one day from now. Or one decade, or one generation from now,
and especially when we've got that little bovis pop through the other week, and you know that could have been anything, could have been something a lot worse.
A very good point, and you know that reminds us, as if we needed any reminder, that we are not as diversified an economy as we ought to be. Now, yeah. None of this would matter if we relied on many different sources of activity for our income. But we have, and we've been talking about this since I was a kid and having conferences asking how are we going to diversify, and we're still not diversified enough.
And on that topic, I heard a suggestion yesterday that it's the proliferation of pine trees near Kauri Forest that may be carrying the Kauri dieback disease.
That's one fairly learned theory.
That may be where it's hiding away, and we really haven't got to grips with just how gnarly that could be. How we may not have any kauri tree. I mean, that's.
We've heard it with the
painted apple moth, and we've heard it with the fruit fly, there were hordes and hordes in there. But this is a different. This is a disease. This goes all through pigs. You know, pigs running through the forest, they carry it. People walking through the forest, they carry it. You know, the wind blows it. The trees, you know, wash off the trees down the hill into the orange.
And realistically,
are we caring enough about it? Do you think?
It's fair enough. I think it's fair enough to say that administration has not, our bureaucratic response has not been strong enough. PSA is a good example of that. And the reason that happened, I would suggest, is because you had 9 years of believing that less government is better for us. And so all of those bureaucratic strengths were eroded by under-resourcing. And I look at how Dieback, Kauri Dieback, has been dealt with over the last few years, and I think you could make a good case for that as well, to say there just weren't enough administrative resources to give the whole thing some heft. And it's also possible that no matter how much resource you've got, you can't actually succeed in the face of this marauding primary industry. Like, as you say, the pine, and if you've got pine forests as the actual
incubator of it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is only a theory, but it was a theory from a fairly learned individual.
It's intriguing, and it kind of makes sense. And you look at M. Bovis, and that's probably an illustration of intense agricultural activity at some point or other coming unstuck. And you know, maybe we need less of it and more of that diversification we were just talking about.
What about nurses and what about teachers this week? Interesting weeks for them.
Yeah, I would like to see somebody being asked, why in the last 3 terms of government were you not considering industrial action then? Is it a little bit like that old, there was that famous bank robber in America. They said, why do you keep Willie Horton? No, that's a different name. It's a notorious presidential election name. the guy, they said to him, why do you keep robbing banks? He said, that's where the money is. And it's, arguably, you strike under a Labor government because that's where the potential resolution is. Whereas if you strike under a National government, they'll just stay stony faced and you'll get nowhere.
Or take all the money out of buildings keeping things shipshape.
But let's start with the fundamental proposition: are they paid enough? No, they're not paid enough.
No. And, are they expected to do too much? Yes.
Yeah. So how about we try and fix it? And
we're entering, like Tess and I were talking about this the other day, and I've talked to Jacinda about it before as well. You know, we're entering, if everything goes to plan, if all the steering of the of the population, you know, if the sort of the steering of the new government goes where it's supposed to go, we're going to have a lot of really qualified councillors. And a lot of really qualified people at the coalface there for mental health and for drug addiction and for you know, for rehabilitation when we're trying to empty out the prisons a wee bit, all that sort of stuff. And that's sort of, I mean, that's all on the outskirts. I know, I'm not sure exactly how close it runs alongside nursing, but it's nursing to an extent, isn't it?
Well, you know,
it's healthcare.
It's quite a nice illustration of quite a nice answer to the question, where are all the jobs going to be when the robots take ours? Well, actually, that kind of work is front and centre.
Yeah, people have robot anxiety.
Yeah, well, that amongst other things, that's right. You know, it's not simple. It requires a lot of resources and a lot of people. But that is what we've been dealing with for the last decade or so, trying to deal with a philosophy of government that says we don't need to give any of these things the resources they need. So now we've got a whole lot of accumulated problems that cannot be fixed quickly. And yet, let's take KiwiBuild, for example. You had the announcement yesterday of the way in which the system will work, and immediately people were saying, oh, well, it's not enough, and the cap for qualifying is way too high. Without sort of recognising that the object of all of this is to finally get a degree and a level of supply in the market that stops the scarcity pushing the prices up. Now, obviously, you're not going to achieve that in a day or a week or a month. You might do it in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, but until you do, you've got to be rationing it, balancing it, and so you end up with the kind of scenario that we were hearing being denigrated yesterday. When in fact, that's only a means for managing things while we get to the position that we need to get to.
So the final caps, just for people who may not have heard, was if you're an individual,
cap, 120. Income of 120,000 a year, and if you're a couple, 180,000 a year.
Any more than that, and you're expected to be able to raise your own funds to at least for a deposit for a house.
To get into the Auckland market, where it is bloody impossible to get yourself a house for less than hundreds and hundreds and, you know, realistic
I can't believe that only 6,000 people have expressed interest so far.
15,000.
It'd be double that by today, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think you can expect to see it up to, you know, many tens of thousands more.
Which is the point of it, I suppose, isn't it?
Talk about it. Oh, it is. And because you've got to reach a point where there's enough supply and there's enough building going on so that the supply meets the demand, and the crazy spiraling of price inflation stops. And on top of that, and there's more. You've got to be doing some work in making affordable apartments, I would say, and that is part of the KiwiBuild program expectation, that it won't just be freestanding big houses; it will be affordable apartments as well. And I think that's where you potentially have your last best chance of making this work, because I think you've got to be finding a way to provide apartments for, I don't know, $200,000-$400,000, so that people have that way in as well.
And places where people can live and like have a life and contribute to the area around them. You know, have good.
Oh,
gotcha.
You know, like
community.
Well, you bet. And that takes us back to last week's issue about the fuel tax, where people were saying, you know, that you're unduly punishing poor people. Actually, if you can have intensification and abundance of public transport so that it's easy to live and work and travel in a local area, you don't need a car then, and you're not being punished with expensive petrol, and you're not being punished with the cost of running a car, which for the most modest of cars, quickly adds up to a hell of a lot of money.
My biggest concern isn't the regional fuel tax. It's the sneaky price raising that the gas companies will do underneath that, using that as an excuse. You know, people are used to it now. Up it goes. Oh, up again. Oh, look at that, $3. Oh, sorry. Oh, God, sorry.
Yeah.
We've got expenses as well. Hey, David, that's us for the morning. Thank you very much.
Very good, Mikey.
Lovely to talk to you, David Slack, ladies and gentlemen.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.